Jesus is standing trial before Pilate, and his life is hanging in the balance. For Pilate, all he knows is some angry mob wants this guy dead, and so he's trying to understand if this guy is a revolutionary. Is he a king? He's heard rumors that this guy's a king. And so he's trying to find out, is this guy a rival? Is he a threat to me or Rome? And so he starts inquiring of Jesus. Jesus, what are you? What are your politics? What kind of government do you want to form? What kind of political system are you trying to usher in? Jesus, what exactly are your politics? Which I suppose might be on some of our minds right now, given we're in the midst, or at the beginning, I should say, of a federal election. What are Jesus' politics? It's not easy to understand given the political references we have to work with, but as Jesus is standing before Pilate being tried and questioned, his answer is this. Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest by the Jewish leaders, but now my kingdom is from another place," which sounds confusing to me, though clearly political. He does speak of a kingdom, and yet it's not of this world. It's from another place, which I take to mean simply this. Jesus' politics doesn't look like any party or political reference we have created or yet imagined. But why? Well, what I want to do over the next several weeks with our new series is focus on politics and power through the lens of art and scripture. And I realized this summer, looking back, I haven't done a series on art since like season 4, which seemed to me like a thing to remedy. And so I want to take us through the next few weeks some of the greatest paintings the world has ever produced, and I want to pair them with stories from scripture, and I think we're going to find some surprising and enlightening things along the way. So let's begin. It's France, and it's 1789. There's social turmoil everywhere as the social hierarchy of France is being seriously called into question. See, during this time, the people of France, they were under a monarchy, and that was followed by a hierarchy of things they called estates. The first estate included the clergy. They were top of the line. The second estate included nobles, and the third estate included the commoners, the peasants, the bourgeoisie. And things are not going well for the third estate. They have no voice, they have no power, and they pay virtually all of the nation's taxes so that the monarchy and the clergy and the nobles can live lives of luxury. And tensions are rising until the powder keg of resentment that's been reaching a fever pitch, it blows with the storming of the Bastille. And with that, a group of delegates representing the third estate, they call themselves the National Convention, they make certain demands of the king, and they eventually take over the country. And for the next 10 years, the French Revolution would play out, and its goals and aims were noble. To give the average citizen more voice and power, it created a declaration of the rights of man and of the citizen. All citizens were declared equal. Property rights were established. Representative government. Part of its legacy, of course, is that it brought new ideas to Europe, including liberty and freedom of the commoner, as well as it would eventually lead to the abolishment of slavery, the rights of women. The French Revolution had many lingering effects, and yet, by any measure, in my mind, it was still a failure. The French Revolution ended in a military coup that would see Napoleon seize control of the nation and move the country back under the role of a military dictatorship. And while some people have said, well, Napoleon was kind of a benevolent dictator, it betrays the fact that the wars he waged cost 5 million lives in Europe, 1 million of them from the French themselves. And so a revolution that began as a quest to give people more freedom ended with a military dictator, the lives of millions of people lost. What went wrong? And I think the answer lies within the revolution itself. It might actually lie within one painting itself. Within the revolution, there was something, a dark stain, simply known as the terror. It was probably the closest Western Europe ever came to something like the horrors of Rwanda. When the National Convention took over during the revolution, they were concerned that only they could bring about the redemption of the French people. They were the ones who could liberate the French. And beholden to their political ideology, they wanted to stamp out any opposition to the revolution, and so they imposed terror laws. laws passed that said anyone suspected of treason could be arrested and executed by the guillotine. And at its height, the terror, nearly 2,000 heads a month rolled in Paris. Many, of course, were political rivals, but the vast majority of the people executed were commoners from the Third Estate itself. And so a revolution that began for commoners ended up killing its own, often simply because of the crime of being too lukewarm in support of the revolution. Some things never change. You see, the ideology of the revolution became more important than the people the ideology was supposed to serve. The purity of the politics of the revolution superseded everything else. It was only the revolution that France was undertaking. That's the only place peace could be found. If a few thousand heads had to roll, well, then so be it. And this is where it gets interesting, because in the middle of this like bloody storm was the preeminent painter of the day, Jacques Louis David. And he was all in on the revolution. In fact, he personally signed 300 death warrants himself as a member of the Security Council. But that's not all he offered the revolution. He also painted its greatest painting. He was called upon to turn one man into a hero and a saint of religious proportions. His name was Jean-Paul Marat. And Jean-Paul Marat was not the kind of person you would normally associate with a hero. He was described as ugly and short, and he suffered from a skin disease that left his face all scarred. He called it leprous. And to ease his discomfort, he would sit in a bath of cold water all day. He would do his daily business from the bathtub, a board serving as his desk. And he would dip a towel in vinegar and wrap it around his head to ease his pain. And he published what was called The Friend of the People. He was a journalist for them. And this journal inflamed passions. It called for the ideological purity of the revolution. And eventually he began to call for thousands of heads to roll. And then he stopped and corrected himself and said, no, hundreds of thousands of heads need to roll. Anyone who doesn't agree with us, the revolution, must pay with their neck. And it went well beyond, again, calling for beheadings of the aristocracy. As a journalist, this went well beyond that. An accusation was enough to find your neck in the guillotine. In fact, 70% of those killed, again, were from the lower classes. All it took was a dispute with a neighbor, and you'd be like, I know how I can get rid of this awful neighbor. I'll accuse them of being a traitor. And so his assassin, Charlotte Corday, she called him the monster. And she arrives in Paris with a 6-inch kitchen knife and a note pinned inside her dress explaining what she was about to do. She called Marat the savage beast who is fattened on the blood of Frenchmen. And so on the evening of July 13th, 1793, she heads to his apartment and flashes him a list of traitors. Intrigued, he calls her to the side of his bathtub and says to her, don't worry, in a few days I'll have them all guillotined in Paris. But it was a phony, of course. And with that, she pulled out her knife, stabbed him once in the chest, severing his aorta, puncturing a lung. A jet spray of blood crossed the room, covering Charlotte as she tried to run away, and Marat dies calling out for his friends. 4 days later, Charlotte is beheaded for her crime, saying, I killed one man to save hundreds of thousands of lives. But she was wrong. His death ended up unleashing the worst of the terror. The assassination now became a cause. The revolution needed to be and remain pure, and his death would now be seen as the torch, the mantle to be carried on, and they tasked one man with making sure it did. Jacques Louis David, create us a peace that will rally the people around the revolution. And so he spent 3 months working on what would come to be seen as his masterpiece. This is it here, The Death of Marat. And when it was finished, the propaganda machine went into full high gear. They paraded it around Paris. Copies of it were sent to all the other cities in France. The intent was to rally people around the revolution while sharpening the guillotine blade. And it worked. The massacres of the terror ramped up into high gear. Your head gone for even questioning the revolution. And eventually, when the terror and revolution collapsed, as France sobered up from the drunken violence of the revolution, they suddenly became ashamed. What have we done? How did we get here where we're killing our own people? How did we allow the ideals of the revolution to get to this? And the portrait would become a symbol of national shame. It would go and be covered up and hidden away. It would become a warning that giving into ideological purity had unleashed the worst in them. And so it was removed from public eye. And yet, in the 20th century, it would come to be seen as a masterpiece with a warning. When politics supersedes people, it becomes demonic. When political purity becomes messiah, politics has become an idolatry of the worst kind. The painting is a genius work of art, but it's also a nightmare because of what it unleashed. And Richard Nilsson says this, part of the reason it became such a terror, this painting, is because of the religious undertones of it. You can see it against a statue here of Jesus after he has died. And Richard Nilsson says this, David's painting is hugely original, mixing in an almost journalistic sense of the here and now with familiar iconographic symbols, turning the dying journalist Murat into a Christ figure. That isn't just a coincidence. The subconscious reading of the painting can't help seeing the echoes of earlier religious works. David was able to mythologize current events and give them depth and power. He weaponized art. The historian Simon Schama picks up on this when he says this, if there's ever a picture that would make you want to die for a cause, it's Jacques Louis David's Death of Murat. And that's what makes it so dangerous. Hidden from view for so many years, I'm not sure how I feel about this painting except deeply conflicted. You can't doubt that it's a solid gold masterpiece, but that's to separate it from the appalling moment of its creation, the French Revolution. If ever a work of art says that beauty can be lethal, it's David's Murat. And I don't know about you, but knowing the history of this piece, I find it haunting. It's a work that reminds us politics is not neutral. And even the most beautiful of ideals can become lethal. It reminds me that under the possession of political zeal, we can all become cruel and barbaric people. It reminds me that when politics becomes our messiah, tragedy often awaits. And this is a lesson we see play out in history, but the same story plays out time and time again in the pages of Scripture, particularly the Old Testament. And in the next few weeks, what I want to do is I want to dive into the politics and power at play in the Old Testament, and I totally understand that for many people, the Old Testament probably produces more angst and anxiety and doubt than almost any other aspect of faith. Its stories are so brutal and barbaric. I just read through Joshua last week. Whew, that's something. Verse after verse, we destroy them all, destroy them all, destroy them all. Mind you, the people that they apparently destroyed, all of them show up again later, so there's that, but it's a barbaric book. It feels barbaric about it. And yet, I hope over these next few weeks, I want to give us a fresh perspective on the Old Testament because there's something important going on here. And to start this morning, I just want to make two observations about the Old Testament before we sort of bring it back into our realm here. My first observation is simply this. The Old Testament as a story is a tragedy. It's a complete tragedy. And when you take a snapshot of the history, what the book covers, all you can do is leave concluding it ends in utter catastrophe. I mean, take a look at the history of the Hebrew people here. Their story is rooted and starts in the Garden of Eden, which they are, of course, exiled from. And that is such a huge identity notion. They're exiled out of the garden. And then God starts to try to turn the ship around with the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. But that quickly goes sideways as well. They end up in Egyptian exile. They're exiled in Egypt in bondage. God delivers them. Then they become this nomadic tribe in the wilderness, and there's enemies fighting them from around, but they survive, and they return to and reclaim the land of their ancestors, the land of Canaan. And then they become this coalition of tribes, and they have land, and things are going well. And then they decide, you know what? We need a monarch like everybody else. And this is when they give in to the dominant politics of the day. We can't afford not to play by the rules of politics around us, so let's set up a monarchy. And before you know it, they're at civil war. The kingdom is divided amongst itself. Civil war, tension. And then they become a people in exile. It starts first with the northern kingdom, exiled to Assyria. 10 of the 12 tribes are exiled to Assyria and are lost forever. Never come back home. And then the southern kingdom, Judah, goes into exile into Babylon. And then after some time, they're allowed to return home. But what they return home to is a scene of complete devastation. Their land is gone. Their temple is ruined. 10 of the 12 tribes are completely gone. It's a shadow of its former self. And that's how the Old Testament ends. In catastrophe, in tragedy. And it doesn't get any better when the story picks up in the New Testament. They find themselves enslaved under Rome. They're in exile in their own land. And then in AD 70, there's destruction of the Jerusalem and the entire temple. In AD 140, the dispersion of the Jews from Palestine. Rome will not permit any Jew to live in Palestine. And essentially, fast forward 2,000 years and until the 20th century, that's how the story goes. It's a tragedy. And when you look at the story of the Old Testament this way, it changes the lens of how we see it. The Old Testament is not an instruction manual on how a nation should run. In fact, precisely the opposite. The story is one of tragedy. Even Jesus attests to this. He's wandering into Jerusalem, and he can see it from a distance, and he begins to weep. As he approached Jerusalem and saw the city, he wept over it and said, "If you, even you, had only known on this day what would bring you peace." And so the story of the Old Testament of the Hebrew people is one of tragedy. But I also want to show you something that I think twists things for us. I want to show you when all of the books of the Old Testament were written or finished. And I think this is important. Because the second observation I want to make is this. The entirety of the Old Testament was written as a response to a single question. And that question was this. How did we get here? Take a look at when the books were written. You'll notice a few things. Most of the books were written when the people were in exile or in post-exilic period. The books that were written when they had a king are all prophets whose job was to say, "Hey, king, we're going the wrong way. We're heading down the wrong path." Called the king into question. The rest of the books come when they're in exile or after the exile. And to me, that means that all of these books had a question in mind. How did we end in ruin? How did we get here? How in the hell, as a people, did we end up here? Most of our people carted off, never to return, our land completely in ruin. We're in constant exile, broken, a shadow of our former selves. How did we get here? And to me, it's the same. You think about the French Revolution as they took Death of Marat off the wall and put it into hiding with shame. The question for the French Revolution was, how did we end up here doing this to ourselves? It's the same for the history of the Hebrew people. How did it come to this? And I want to say this, the overwhelming response of the Old Testament through poems and stories and fantastic tales is the reason they found themselves where they were is because of idolatry. And I know that's like this weird word, idolatry, and we tend to think of it as like some wooden statue we think has some power. But the reality is an idol was just a material representation of ideas. Ideas about where does power come from? What's required for us to be safe as a people? Who ultimately runs the show, the world? Where does salvation and hope come from? And time again throughout the Old Testament, the diagnosis for why the Hebrew story ends in tragedy is they gave into idolatry, forgot who they were. They forgot God is the one who saves and liberates, and instead they bought into false ideas about where hope and salvation and power come from. And when you put that lens of how did we get here in front of the stories of the Old Testament, it suddenly shifts things. Because suddenly when you read a story about blood and violence and guts and gore, we have to ask ourselves, wait. Is the Old Testament glorifying war, or is it showcasing it as a false idol that leads to devastation. If you're asking yourself how you got to ruin and you look back at your own violent history, maybe you're starting to question the methods that took you to where you are. And so I want to argue this was the question behind every book. And what it all points to is idolatry has caused this tragedy. Of course, this is not a story unique to the Hebrew people. It's a story that's played out time and time again through history. It happened in the French Revolution. Purity of political ideology became an idol, and it led to the guillotine. And I would say this, it's still happening today. So, at the outset of another election, let me probably do something stupid and ruffle a few feathers and point out an idol I think we often fall prey to as well, and that's politics. I think politics has become an idol. Let me ask this as someone who, a confession here, has already, 3 days into the campaign, I've already watched and participated in a number of rather spirited conversations about politics. I want to ask the question, why does so much of our political discourse feel toxic? There's probably a number of reasons we could point to, but I want to consider again my two examples. The French Revolution, the tragedy of the Old Testament. French Revolution resorted to the terrors because they had to get it right. If they didn't get the revolution right, everything could fail. If that meant taking heads, so be it. Get it wrong, and everything will fall apart. There has to be a purity. Or consider the Old Testament. For the entirety of their story, they had been tossed around by nation after nation, and finally they said, we have to get this right. We have to play politics the same way everybody else does. What we need is a king. We'll see in a few weeks' time. That was the beginning of the end for them. I mean, consider the hot, negative emotions that get stirred up during political debates, right? For some of us, these can feel like some of the most extreme social emotions we ever experience. And if you don't believe me, I mean, just look at the rhetoric, not just south of the border, but here at home. If this party, pick your poison, if this party gets in, the sky will fall. We're doomed. And strangely enough, when politics gets overheated and intense, I think many of us probably plan to spend the next 40 days with our heads buried in the sand, hoping the thing will end soon. But I'm inclined to think this: politics is a spiritual power that creates conflict. Because why do our emotions get so hot when we talk about politics? First, anytime our emotions get heated up, it's a sign we think stakes are very high, right? I mean, we generally don't get angry over trivialities. Our emotions get fired up about politics because we think something vital is at risk here. And given that it generates hot emotions in us, it might mean that we believe the biggest, most important stuff in the world is hanging in the balance when we talk about politics. Second, our emotions are not abstract. We get angry at people. We get angry at people we think might vote the wrong way. It's going to mess everything up. And so politics is so full of conflict because we feel, perhaps consciously or unconsciously, that it's all up to us as a people or a nation. Sort of think to ourselves, people, come on, we have to get this right. Don't you understand? If we don't get this decision right, we're doomed. We have to get it right because only we can save ourselves. Collectively, if we vote the wrong way, it's almost apocalyptic scenarios come into our mind, doomsday scenarios. We have to get this right. If we don't, we're all screwed. And to me, this makes politics a religious debate. Politics is a form of religion complete with believers and heretics, sinners and saints. And I get that this might be making some of us uncomfortable. I get that. Let me say, I'm not suggesting we don't vote along with all the wisdom we can muster up. Of course we do. But I'm very interested in a phenomenon that most of us can talk about issues of faith here with relative calmness. This person doesn't believe in the Trinity. This person has doubts about the resurrection. This person atheist, agnostic. And generally, we can talk about that calmly. We can agree to disagree on the Bible or whatever. But what I've noticed is I know very few political opposites who can talk calmly with each other. It sort of suggests to me that we believe politics is actually more important than God. Want to disagree about God or the Bible? Cool, whatever. Wait, you disagree with me about government size? Or taxation policies? Or what a party will or won't do about the environment or immigration or abortion? Now that's an issue of biblical proportions. If we get this wrong, don't you see, we're done. The future hangs in the balance. It's on us to make sure we get this right. And so I've come to see politics as the human quest to be God, the quest to save ourselves. And when that happens, I fear our political ideology becomes Messiah. Worship the Messiah, defend it vigorously. Rarely in political discussions about the future do we ever stop to ask, might God's Spirit be at work in this world? Might God's Spirit be continually redeeming outside of politics and policy? Maybe. And oftentimes I think we don't ask that question because ultimately we do believe we're alone and that it's our job to save ourselves from some future apocalypse. And to me, this is the danger because this is the story of the French Revolution. Political ideology of the day was Messiah, necks severed, if that's necessary, sure. It's the same story playing out in the Old Testament. Be a blessing to other nations, forget that. We're at risk, give us a king. Let us form an empire. For many of us, I think politics has become an idol because it understates our belief only we can save ourselves. It's up to us to collectively get it right, and if we don't, the apocalypse shall come. And it also makes political enemies, because those who disagree with us don't agree with the vision, well, they must be bent on our destruction. I can see no other way of explaining why politics gets so heated and emotionally hot. It's a false idol turning us against each other, driving the deepest wedges between all of us in the promise of the revolution that will save us. And in biblical language, that to me is idolatry. And I know there are a lot of people here, very politically active, very passionate about politics. Please don't hear me wrong. I'm not arguing for a passive role. I'm not arguing against not showing up to vote. I think, to be honest, we have a responsibility to think carefully, vote wisely. But the cautionary tale for me is this: if we think voting the right way is the only thing that will save us or make us great again or help us choose forward, if we believe it's up to us to get it right and that if we don't, we're screwed, I just want to ask you if perhaps the purity and promise of politics might have become an idol for us. And I can feel tension in the air. But before we get into all that this election campaign will bring, maybe we could say, what if there's a power underneath this working to create conflict? And what if it all doesn't rest on us? Because the Christian path asks us to believe that God's Spirit is always at work, no matter which way political winds blow. She is always at work saving, redeeming, liberating, wooing us forward, and whispering to our anxious hearts, you're not alone. I'm at work beyond what you can see. There's another kingdom. There's another political world alive and at work, and so she beckons to us, trust me. And the question for us is, can we?